Professor Craig Clunas is an eminent historian of the art and history of China and is currently Professor of the History of Arts at the University of Oxford. Although he has focused on the Ming period of Chinese history from 1368 to 1644, Professor Clunas's other work includes the material and visual of China from around 1200. On top of this, he also has research and teaching interests in 20th century and contemporary Chinese art and in the methodology of art history. Professor Clunas obtained a first class degree in Chinese studies from the University of Cambridge and moved to the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, where he completed his PhD. He spent 15 years at London's Victoria and Albert Museum before moving to the University of Sussex in 1994, and then 3 years later became its Professor of Art History. In 2003, he returned to the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London as the Percival David Professor of Chinese and East Asian Art, before joining Oxford 3 years ago as first holder of the chair in the History of Art to specialise in art from Asia. Professor Clunas has published extensively on early modern China. He has been awarded an honorary Doctor of Letters. Welcome to Warwick and congratulations on receiving your honorary degree. What does this award mean to you?
Well, it's the first honorary degree that anyone's ever been pleased to honour me with. So, you know, it's tremendous, really. I was very moved when Michael Hatt was talking about, you know, what I'd done, and I thought, well, yes, I did do those things, but I didn't always see them like that. You know, you're looking back. When you're working on stuff, you're looking forward and thinking about the current project and so on. But when somebody else stands back and sees it as a totality and you think, yes, I did do that, it's rather touching. Well, not rather touching, it's very touching.
What is it that interests you in Chinese art and the Ming period in particular?
As I said, in what I said, I didn't really start as an art historian. I started as a scholar of China. And the Ming period wasn't necessarily the period that I was most interested in. And it sort of snuck up on me. I think it's something to do with the fact that for longer ago periods, we don't have enough documentation to really be able to get a grasp of the culture in all its richness and complexity. For more recent periods, there's almost too much material to handle. So in some ways, the Ming falls in that period where we have a lot of things from it. We have a lot of actual art from the period. And a wide range of the art. From earlier periods, we might have a small number of splendid things, but we don't have the complete range. So the Ming period's almost the earliest period of Chinese history from what we've got the complete range of things. And what's always fascinated me is not one particular art form, although I've written books about individual art forms. What's always fascinated me has been how the system of images and objects, how that fits together to make a total culture, a total civilization. And the Ming is really the earliest period for which I think it's possible to do that.
After working for 15 years at the Victoria and Albert Museum, what made you decide to join the University of Sussex?
Well, I suppose one of the things was that I was increasingly becoming interested in issues around kinds of artwork that the museum didn't have. There's a sort of almost a moral imperative that a museum curator writes about works on the collections, and I'd written books on Chinese furniture and Chinese carving and Chinese export painting and sorts of categories of things that the museum had. But I'd become particularly interested in the history of gardens and gardening in China as a cultural form, and I was writing a book in the early 90s about the history of gardens. And, of course, that's one thing that, by definition, there's no gardens in the collection. I'd also had the opportunity to sort of dip my toe into postgraduate teaching, because in the 1980s, the museum started up a master's program, an MA in the history of design, along with the Royal College of Art. And I had done some teaching on this program, methodology, and I was interested in the methodology of art history. That is, you know, how do we interpret objects? What kind of evidence for the past are objects and images. And so I'd had that little bit of teaching experience. And then when the University of Sussex, because I think the thing that may not be obvious now, but of course, I mean, when I joined the University of Sussex in the early 90s, I was the only person in a British art history department who worked on Chinese things other than the School of Oriental and African Studies, which is a specialist bit of the University of London to do with the teaching on Asia and Africa. But at that point, and it's changed a bit, but it still needs to change a bit further, the history of art in Britain was a very Eurocentric discipline. So in a way, when Sussex gave me the opportunity and said, do you want to come and kind of build up the teaching on Chinese art within an art history context, that was a very attractive proposition, and it was an exciting department with exciting colleagues that I wanted to work with.
You have written a host of books on early modern China, the last in 2007. Are you currently working on any other titles, or are you concentrating more on teaching and research?
No, I've got a couple of projects on the go. I'm at the moment finishing up a book, which I hope to have the manuscript finished this Christmas, which is about the Ming period. I the more I look into it, I haven't got bored with it yet. But that's about a rather different, it's a different take. It's almost like I'm saying to myself, well, maybe you've had it wrong all of these years. Let's look at it in a completely different way. And so what I'm looking at is not the urban city sort of culture of the lower Yangtze Delta, which is what we often think about when we think about Minghai culture. But what I'm looking at is other areas of this vast empire where the key cultural players were not scholars or members of the imperial bureaucracy, but were members of the imperial aristocracy. That is, they were minor branches of the imperial family. And once you go to the vast inland provinces, you find a completely different Ming dynasty. And it's rather like the issue, you know, of China today, that, you know, the China that we think of as booming and prosperous and so on is the coastal urban China, Shanghai and the other great cities. But there's a whole other China kind of inland, which is a quite sort of different place. And so I'm looking at this different place in the Ming and kind of thinking about a quite different Ming, a kind of aristocratic Ming, a courtly Ming, a different culture. And it's partly like I'm saying, well, I wonder if I've had it right all along. And then in 2012, I'm giving a series of lectures called the Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts at the National Gallery in Washington. And they will be I'm not quite sure what they'll be about yet. I haven't formally given them a title, but they're likely to be some overview topic, a broad topic. What I think I'd like to do is to look at the way that Chinese painting and the audiences for Chinese painting, and in particular the global audiences for Chinese painting, have changed from the 16th century to the 20th century, and look at how people have looked at it, how different audiences have looked at it, both inside China and outside China. But I'm also working on a big exhibition with the British Museum on the early Ming period, which is planned for the British Museum in 2014. And that comes back to the early 15th century and to some of this aristocratic culture, where there have been very wonderful recent archaeological discoveries. And I'm hoping it will be possible to borrow some of this material from museums in China, because I think it will knock people's eyes out. It's very spectacular material, and it's never been seen outside China, or often because some of it's only been excavated fairly recently.
Over the years, you have attended several of the country's top universities as a student and on the staff. How do you think Warwick compares to the other institutes you have been to?
Well, I'm looking at Warwick from the outside, and of course I only know a small part of it. But I would certainly identify, from my work, I would certainly identify Warwick as somewhere that's been very very much at the cutting edge of a move to a history which is both sensitive to larger global things and specific about the individual cultures that it studies. I mean, there's a way, if you like, of doing global history which is a bit kind of wishy-washy, which says that the only interesting things are the points of contact and not the cultural specifics. And certainly the colleagues that I know and have, you know, interacted with at Warwick, many of them in the history department, as well as in history of art, have taken that much kind of that much broader view. So, you know, it's clearly an institution that's pushing the envelope there, and was for example one of the first universities in Britain to have people who worked specifically on China within the history department. I think the model that I was trained in, you see, I was trained in a very much a kind of Oriental studies model where you had a kind of separate bit where you put everything to do with Asia. That was how I learned about China at Cambridge as an undergraduate within the Faculty of Oriental Studies. And then I attended the School of Oriental and African Studies, which is a wonderful institution in many ways, but was created specifically to be a place that did Asia, almost so that everybody else didn't have to. And I think nowadays you both want those specialist institutions, but you also want kind of the study of Asia to be present in all kinds of places. And I certainly see Warwick as somewhere that's been at the forefront of doing that.
And finally, what life advice would you give to your fellow graduates today?
Well, really, what I said in the hall, that well, I'm not sure. I think also the older you get, the less willing you are to just give life advice to people, to say, now look, boys and girls, this is what you know. It doesn't feel comfortable. I don't feel comfortable doing that. I think, you know, I mean, a mantra I've often used more with graduate students, this is more graduate student advice than life advice, but it's almost kind of life advice as well, which is plans are important and will change. Not might change, but will change. That is, you have to kind of, it's helpful to have some sense of what you might be going to do, but it's going to be different. I mean, I absolutely, at my graduation, did not think that I would have done what I've done. And life was full of surprises in the sense that the very first job I ever applied for was a job teaching Chinese literature at a university in Australia. Now, I didn't get it, but if I had been offered it, I would have taken it gladly. I would have been delighted to go off to Australia and teach Chinese literature, and I wouldn't have been sitting in Australia thinking, oh, I wish I'd become an art historian and got an honorary degree from Warwick. You know, it would have been, you know, it would have been a different life. So I think that, and I think stuff about intellectual curiosity is important. I think stuff about, you know, mutual respect and just treating one another with decorum is important, but you know, people they know that. You know, you don't need a middle-aged bloke in a funny robe to tell you these kind of things. This is not advice. This is what we all know.